Gentleman from New York, Mr. Smith.
Mr. President, in regard to your answer on page 18 of your statement of whether you consulted with certain persons, and in that connection, and in connection with question number 6 of H.R. 1367, you stated in regard to the vice presidential nominee, Nelson Rockefeller, that your only conversation on the subject with him was to report to him on September 6, 1974, that I was planning to grant the pardon. Now, the question asks whether he gave you any facts or legal authorities, and my question is, did he do so?
Nelson Rockefeller did not give me any facts or legal authorities. He was in my office to discuss with me the proceedings concerning his nomination. And at the conclusion of a discussion on that matter, I felt that I should inform him of the possible or prospective action that I would be taking. But he gave me no facts, he gave me no legal advice concerning the pardon.
Mr. President, as you were minority leader of the Congress before you became Vice President of the United States, did you at any time discuss the wisdom or advisability of a possible presidential pardon for President Nixon with President Nixon or any of his representatives or any member of the White House staff? This was in the period before you became Vice President.
The answer is categorically no. Before I became Vice President, Mr. Smith, I on several occasions, I can't recall how many, indicated to President Nixon himself that I thought he should not resign. If my memory is accurate, Mr. Smith, before I became Vice President, there were individuals both in the Congress and otherwise who were advocating that Mr. Nixon resign. I do recall on one or more occasions telling Mr. Nixon, in my judgment, he should not, because I thought that would be an admission of guilt. And on the information I had at that time, I did not believe Mr. Nixon was guilty of any impeachable offense.
Thank you, Mr. President. You touched upon your observations of President Nixon's health, and I wonder whether at any time before you became Vice President of the United States, did you learn any facts about his physical or mental health which later became relevant to your decision to pardon Mr. Nixon?
Before I was Vice President, I saw Mr. Nixon periodically coming to the White House for leadership meetings or for other reasons. And during that period, I had the distinct impression that his health was good. And I didn't see any discernible change, in my own opinion, until the last day or two of his presidency. And I did notice the last time I saw him in the Oval Office on August 9th, I thought he was drawn and possibly a little thinner. But that's the only observation I made.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Gentleman from California, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. President, on pages 10 and 11 of your statement, you indicate that there were some general discussions with General Haig and Mr. St. Clair before the resignation about the pardon power in general. Did they have any reason to carry a message to then-President Nixon that this pardon power could possibly be used on his behalf if he resigned?
None whatsoever. Categorically, no.
Then why, Mr. President, was those general discussions about pardon?
Well, as I indicated in my prepared statement, General Haig came to me first to apprise me of the dramatic change in the situation. And as I indicated in the prepared statement, told me that I should be prepared to assume the presidency very quickly and wanted to know whether I was ready to do that. Secondly, he did indicate that in the White House, among the president's advisors, there were many options being discussed as to what course of action the president should take. And in the course of my discussion on August 1 with General Haig, he outlined, as I did in the prepared text, the many options that were being discussed. He asked for any recommendations I would make, and as I indicated in the prepared text, I made none.
Thank you. Mr. President, Mr. Buchan said several times, and I believe you have mentioned, that the pardon did involve a certain aspect of mercy. Would not the same considerations of mercy apply to the Watergate defendants downtown who now are putting forth as their chief defense their allegation that they were merely acting under orders of Mr. Nixon, then president, and their boss?
Mr. Edwards, in light of the fact that these trials are being carried out at the present time, I think it's inadvisable for me to comment on any of the proceedings in those trials.
Mr. President, put yourself in the position of a high school teacher, shall we say, in Watts or the Barrios of San Jose or Harlem. And if you were such a teacher, how would you explain to the young people of America the American concept of equal justice under law?
Mr. Edwards, Mr. Nixon was the 37th president of the United States. He had been preceded by 36 others. He is the only president in the history of this country who has resigned under shame and disgrace. I think that that in and of itself can be understood, can be explained to students or to others. That was a major, major step and a matter of, I'm sure, grave, grave deliberations by the former president. And it certainly, as I've said several times, constituted shame and disgrace.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, do you think that it is wise to pardon a man before indictment or trial, for offenses that are completely unknown to you and which might possibly be terribly serious?
Well, as I indicated, Mr. Edwards, I did, to the best of my ability, check with probably the best authority in the country on what, if any, charges would be made against Mr. Nixon. Those were, or potentially were, serious charges. I think that in taking the action I did concerning those charges, I was exercising in a proper way the pardon authority given a president under the Constitution.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. Gentleman from Indiana, Mr. Dennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. President, I would like to state that I, too, share with my colleagues a deep appreciation for your appearance here before our subcommittee this morning. Mr. President, on page 7 of your statement, where you were talking about your second interview with General Haig in the afternoon of August 1st, you state that I described this meeting because at one point it did include references to a possible pardon for Mr. Nixon. I take it that you have spelled out what those references were over on pages 9, where the options are spelled out, and page 10, where you state that you inquired as to what was the president's pardon power. Is that
right? Yes, it is spelled out in the itemed instances 1 through 6, the various options involving a pardon.
And does that include everything that was said at that time on the subject of pardon substantially?
Yes, sir.
Mr. President, I note that on page 10 you state that you asked the general as to what the president's pardon power was, and he very properly replied that he had certain information but couldn't give legal opinion. When, where, and from whom did you ultimately obtain the opinion that you were entitled under the doctrine of ex parte Garland and so on to issue a pardon when there had been no charge or no conviction?
When I came back to the Oval Office, Mr. Dennis, following the press conference on August 28th, where three questions were raised by the news media involving a pardon, I instructed my counsel, Mr. Buchan, to check in an authoritative way what pardon power a president had. And he, several days later, I don't recall precisely, came back and briefed me on my pardon power as President of the United States.
Mr. President, the exercise of executive clemency is, of course, a well-recognized part of the legal system in this country, exercised by you and all your predecessors. Is that not the fact?
That is correct, sir.
And you have given this committee, as I understand your testimony this morning, your complete statement as to your reasons for exercising that power in this particular case.
I have, sir.
And in answer to my friend Mr. Edwards, you have stated the fact that you felt that for an ex-president of the United States to resign under these circumstances was sufficient strong punishment, and that that should answer the problems of those who have raised the question of equal justice under law.
That is correct, sir.
And that you would consider other possible pardons on the facts of those particular cases when and if they were presented to you.
That is correct.
And that there was no condition attached to this pardon, and no sort of agreement made in respect thereto before it was granted.
None whatsoever, sir.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have no further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Gentleman from South Carolina, Mr. Mann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. President, Mr. Kastenmeier, I ask you about the termination of the investigation by the Special Prosecutor's Office. Was it your intention by the pardon to terminate the investigation by the Special Prosecutor's Office in the 10 areas that you received a report from that office upon?
I think the net result of the pardon was, in effect, just that. Yes, sir.
And is that part of the reason that you didn't consult with Mr. Jaworski with reference to the tape agreements as to how that might affect his further investigations?
Well, as I pointed out, the tape agreement was initiated between my legal counsel and Mr. Nixon sometime before the question of a pardon ever arose. The reason for that, Mr. Mann, is that I came into office and almost immediately there were demands and requests not only from the special prosecutor, as I recall, but from other sources as to those tapes and other documents. And one of the first things I did when these problems came to my desk was to ask the Attorney General for his opinion as to the ownership of those tapes or any other documents. And once we got that information, then we felt that there ought to be some discussion as to where the tapes and other documents would be held and under what circumstances.
Now, of course, the mandate of the Special Prosecutor's Office was not directed solely at President Nixon. But is it not so that the pardon, in effect, terminated that investigation insofar as other parties, other possible defendants, and getting to the true facts of the matters that have disturbed our national political life during these past 2 years?
I do not believe that the action I took in pardoning President Nixon had any impact on any other mandate that special prosecutor's office had.
What response would you have if the special prosecutor's office now requested access to certain of the tapes now in the custody of the government?
The material that is still held by the government, in my understanding of the Supreme Court decision, permits the special prosecutor to obtain any of that material for its responsibility. And I, of course, not in a personal way, would make certain that that information was made available to the special prosecutor's office.
According to press reports, Mr. Clement Stone visited President Nixon on September the 2nd and thereafter met with you in Washington. Are you at liberty to tell us the gist of the communication involving President Nixon from Mr. Stone to you?
Mr. Stone came to see me about a program that he's used very successfully in his business, a program which he's very proud of, and he was urging me to institute it in the various bureaus and departments of the federal government. There was no other message conveyed by him from Mr. Nixon to me.
Did you ever discuss the pardon with former President Nixon after his resignation and prior to the granting of the pardon?
Will you repeat that again, please?
Did you have any personal conversation with former President Nixon concerning the pardon between his resignation and September the 8th?
Absolutely not.
Now, in response to Mr. Edwards' question about equal justice under the law, I know that you make a distinction that here we are talking about the office of President of the United States. But let's assume that we are talking about president of a bank or governor of a state or chief justice of the United States Supreme Court, in whose minds those are very high political offices. Do you think any of those persons who are allegedly criminally culpable through resignation should be entitled to any treatment different from any other citizen?
Mr. Mann, I don't think I should answer a hypothetical question of that kind. I was dealing with reality, and I have given, in my best judgment, the reasons for the action that I took. And to pass judgment on any other person or individual holding any other office in public or private, I think it would be inappropriate for me.
You've heard the maxim that the law is no respecter of persons. Do you agree with that?
Certainly it should be.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
The gentleman from Iowa, Mr. Maine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. President, I believe that the chairman and others in their questioning have established very clearly that your appearance here today is an entirely voluntary one on your part, that it was your idea, that you had not been requested by the committee to come in person, that we had indicated that it would be entirely satisfactory as far as we were concerned if some assistant appeared instead.
That is correct, sir.
I do not think, however, that it has yet been made clear in the record, and I think this should be, that it is also true that you were willing to come and to tell this full story, as you have done, before the committee and on television, before the American people, much earlier than today. Is that not true?
Yes, I think the original schedule was set for about a week ago. I've forgotten the exact date.
Well, my recollection, and you can correct me if I am wrong, is that as early as September 30th, you offered and volunteered to appear before the subcommittee at our next regular meeting, which would have been on October the 1st. But it was indicated to you that that would be too early for the committee to be able to accommodate such an appearance.
I don't recall that detail, but when I indicated that I would voluntarily appear, a member of my staff met with, I think, Chairman Hungate, and between them, they tried to work out what was an acceptable, agreeable time as to when I should appear.
There was, of course, the concern which developed in the subcommittee as to whether there would be any possible jeopardy to the impaneling of the jury in the Watergate cases. But I think this timetable should be established, and I would ask the chairman if that is not his recollection, that originally the president did say that he would be glad to appear on October 1st.
Not being under oath, the chair is glad to reply. The gentleman, his recollection is the same as mine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just think the point should be made that there has been no stalling at all or delay on the part of the president making this appearance, but that he was not only willing to make the statement, but to do it much earlier.
If the gentleman would yield briefly.
I'm happy to yield.
That is precisely the fact, and it was consideration on behalf of many of us concerning some of the proper effect on any trials that held us till this day.
Mr. President, I think there was perhaps one part of Mr. Kastenmeier's questioning of you that was left unanswered, and I'm going to try to go into that again. Did you, by granting this pardon, have any intention of stopping the investigations of any other defendants or potential defendants?
None whatsoever.
Mr. President, ever since I first heard of the Watergate break-in, I have felt that this was a matter which should be fully investigated and prosecuted, and that anyone found to be criminally involved should be punished as provided by the law. And I have repeatedly stated I thought our American system of justice, as administered in the courts, was fully capable of handling the situation if permitted to proceed without interference. I've been apprehensive that the activities of some of the legislative committees and the large amount of publicity attending upon those activities might make it impossible for our court system to function as it should. And I've also been fearful that the executive branch would intervene to limit or handicap the normal functioning of the courts. Mr. President, I must say to you that I am deeply concerned that both the legislative and executive branches have indeed interfered with our courts, making it extremely difficult for the traditional American system of justice to proceed in the regular manner in this case. And I was very disturbed by the granting of this pardon, particularly at such an early stage, even though certainly there is no question that under the law you had the right to act as you did. Now, I realize that hindsight is always better than foresight, but I'm wondering if, after all that has happened and with further opportunity for reflection, if you do not now feel that you perhaps acted too hastily in this case.
Well, Mr. Main, I have thought about that a great deal because there has been criticism of the timing. But as I reviewed my thoughts prior to the granting of the pardon, I had to look at this factual situation. If I granted the pardon when I did, it would as quickly as possible achieve the results that I wanted, which was to permit our government, both the Congress and the President, to proceed to the solution of the problems. Now, some people say in their criticism, and I understand it, and I'm not critical of the points they raise, I should have waited until Mr. Nixon was indicted, inferring that I should have then pardoned him if I was going to do so. Well, other people say that I should have waited until he was convicted, if he was convicted, and at that time I should have pardoned him. Others have indicated that I should have waited to a conviction and a jail sentence if that were the result. Now, all of that process, whether it's the indictment, the possible conviction, a conviction plus a jail sentence, would have taken, as I've tried to explain, at least a year and probably much longer. And during that whole period of time, Mr. Main, all of the things that I wanted to avoid, namely the opportunity for our government, the President and the Congress and others, to get to the problems we have, would have been, I think, deeply upset and roadblocked. So I'm convinced after reflection, as I was previously, that the timing of the pardon was done at the right time.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you, sir.
Representative New York, Ms. Holzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Ford, I too wish to applaud your historical appearance here today. At the same time, however, I wish to express my dismay that the format of this hearing will not be able to provide to the American public the full truth and all of the facts respecting your issuance of a pardon to Richard Nixon. Unfortunately, each member of this committee will have only 5 minutes in which to ask questions about this most serious matter. And unfortunately, despite my urging, the committee declined to provide sufficient time for each committee member to ask the questions that were appropriate. The committee declined to prepare fully for your coming by calling other witnesses, such as Alexander Haig, Mr. Buchan, Mr. Becker, and has failed to insist also on full production of documents by you respecting the issuance of this pardon. And I must confess my own lack of easiness at participating in a proceeding that has raised such high expectations, and unfortunately will not be able to respond to them. I would like to point out, Mr. President, that the resolutions of inquiry which have prompted your appearance here today have resulted from very dark suspicions that have been created in the public's mind. Perhaps these suspicions are totally unfounded, and I sincerely hope that they are. But nonetheless, we must all confront the reality of these suspicions. And the suspicions that were created by the circumstances of the pardon which you issued, the secrecy with which it was issued, and the reasons for which it was issued, which made people question whether or not, in fact, there was a deal.
May I comment there? I want to assure you, the members of this subcommittee, the members of the Congress, and the American people, there was no deal, period, under no circumstances.
Well, Mr. President, I appreciate that statement, and I'm sure many of the American people do as well. But they also are asking questions about the pardon, and I'd like to specify a few of them for you so that perhaps we can have some of these answered. I think from the mail I've received from all over the country as well as my own district, I know that the people want to understand how you can explain having pardoned Richard Nixon without specifying any of the crimes for which he was pardoned. And how can you explain pardoning Richard Nixon without obtaining any acknowledgement of guilt from him? How do you explain the failure to consult the Attorney General of the United States with respect to the issuance of the pardon, even though in your confirmation hearings you had indicated that the Attorney General's opinion would be critical in any decision to pardon a former president? How can this extraordinary haste in which the pardon was decided on and the secrecy with which it was carried out be explained? And how can you explain the fact that the pardon of Richard Nixon was accompanied by an agreement with respect to the tapes, which in essence, in the public mind, hampered the special prosecutor's access to these materials and was done also in the public's mind in disregard of the public's right to know the full story about Richard Nixon's misconduct in office? And in addition, the public, I think, wants an explanation of how Benton Becker was used to represent the interests of the United States in negotiating a tapes agreement when at that very time he was under investigation by the United States for possible criminal charges. And how also can you explain not having consulted Leon Jaworski, the special prosecutor, before approving of the tapes agreement? And I think, Mr. President, that these are only a few of the questions that have existed in the public's mind before and unfortunately still remain not resolved. And since I have very brief time, I would like to ask you, in addition to these questions, one further one, and that is that suspicions have been raised that the reason for the pardon and the simultaneous tapes agreement was to ensure that the tape recordings between yourself and Richard Nixon never came out in public. To alleviate this suspicion once and for all, would you be willing to turn over to this subcommittee all tape recordings of conversations between yourself and Richard Nixon?
Those tapes, under an opinion of the Attorney General, which I sought, according to the Attorney General, and I might add according to past precedent, belong to President Nixon. Those tapes are in our control. They are under an agreement which protects them totally, fully, for the special prosecutor's office or for any other criminal proceedings. Those tapes will not be delivered to anybody until a satisfactory agreement is reached with the special prosecutor's office. We have held them because his office did request that. And as long as we have them held in our possession for the special prosecutor's benefit, I see no way whatsoever that they can be destroyed, that they can be kept from proper utilization in criminal proceedings. Now, those tapes belong to Mr. Nixon, according to the Attorney General, but they're being held for the benefit of the special prosecutor. And I think that's the proper place for them to be kept.
The gentleman from Maryland, Mr. Hogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm frankly amazed that my good friend, the gentlelady from New York, and her accusatory opening speech, because certainly the gentlelady knows that it is the usual and ordinary and routine procedure of this subcommittee and this committee to operate under the five-minute rule. There is nothing extraordinary about us today allocating 5 minutes of time for questioning to each member of the committee. We always operate this way. Her other observation about not doing any preparatory work by calling other witnesses was rejected, as far as I recall, by all other members of the subcommittee on the basis that this resolution of inquiry is directed to the President of the United States, and properly so. So it would be totally inappropriate for the resolution of inquiry to address itself to individuals other than the subject of that resolution of inquiry.
Mr. President, I would like to join, too, in commending you for your statement and your openness and candor in coming in this very historic event. And frankly, I'm concerned at some of the questioning by my colleagues asking questions if all men aren't equal under the law, because certainly, being the outstanding lawyers that they are, they know that the pardoning power itself is inherently inequitable. But for a larger purpose, it grants to the chief executive of the federal government or the state, in the case of state crimes, to pardon individuals who may or have been indicted or convicted of crimes. So we should not expect this to apply as if there were a trial of these criminal offenses. And furthermore, we also know that in our system of criminal justice, even the prosecutors themselves exercise prosecutive discretion. There is no question whatsoever that the Constitution gives to the President of the United States broad and absolute power to pardon individuals of criminal offenses. We also know from the debates of the framers of the Constitution that they specifically rejected including in the Constitution the words after conviction. They also, in the debate at that time, indicated situations where it might be necessary or desirable to grant a pardon even before indictment, as was the case in this instance. Now, Mr. President, I know that you followed very carefully the deliberations of this committee during the impeachment inquiry. And I know you're also aware that this committee unanimously concluded that the president was guilty of an impeachable offense growing out of obstruction of justice. So, in a sense, couldn't we not say that this was at least the basis for a possible criminal charge, which was already spread on the record with ample evidence to justify it? So those who say you should have waited until there were formalized charges really are overlooking the fact that there was a very formalized charge, an indictment, if you will, by this committee.
Well, the unanimous vote of the House Committee on the Judiciary, all 35 members, certainly is very, very substantial evidence that the former president was guilty of an impeachable offense. There's no doubt in my mind that that recommendation of this full committee would have carried in the House, which would have been even more formal as an indication of criminal activity, or certainly, to be more specific, an impeachable offense. And, of course, the prospects in the Senate with such a formidable vote in the committee and in the House would have been even more persuasive.
Mr. President, referring to the memorandum from Mr. Ruth to Mr. Jaworski enumerating the 10 possible criminal offenses, it's true that this committee addressed itself, if I'm not mistaken, to every single one of these charges and assessed evidence as to each one of them. And we found them wanting, that they were not sufficient justification for an impeachable offense. And the last paragraph of that memorandum says, and I quote, "None of these matters at the moment rises to the level of our ability to prove even a probable criminal violation by Mr. Nixon." Now, this memorandum does not include the obstruction of justice, which I addressed myself to earlier. So I think we can logically assume that there would not have been any indictments resulting from Mr. Jaworski's activities other than in the area of obstruction of justice. And with further corroboration of that point, I allude to a story in the Wall Street Journal yesterday where Mr. Jaworski, who incidentally not only agrees with your pardon, but also the legality and the timeliness of it. And he says very specifically that there was going to be no additional disclosures resulting from his activities that the public was not already aware of relating to Mr. Nixon.
So those who are saying we should wait till there's a formal charge, I think are missing the point that there already has been a formal charge approved by this committee. Now, Mr. President, don't you feel that the very acceptance of the pardon by the former president is tantamount to an admission of guilt on his part?
I do, sir.
So those who say again that they would have preferred that the president admit his culpability before a pardon being issued, again, are overlooking that fact.
The acceptance of a pardon, according to the legal authorities, and we've checked them out very carefully, does indicate that by the acceptance, the person who's accepted it does, in effect, admit guilt.
Thank you, Mr. President. And again, I'd like to express my personal appreciation for your candor and your openness and your cooperation with the co-equal branch.
Thank you very much.
Mr. President, as you can see, the peculiar strength of this subcommittee lies in the fact that the subcommittee members bring so much knowledge to it and the subcommittee chairman takes so little away. And I noticed in your page 10 of your statement that when you were first hit with the possibility of this responsibility, you indicated you want to talk to your wife before making a decision. Mr. President, did you do that?
I certainly did, Mr. Chairman, because the probability or possibility of my becoming president obviously would have had a significant impact on her life as well as our life.
That destroys my theory that if you talked to her, you'd wait until indictment or Christmas Eve. Let me ask if any attempt was made by you or your representative to contact the federal pardon attorney as to his opinion as to customary procedures followed in issuing the pardon.
I did not, sir.
Now, Mr. President, I go to page 20 of the statement, and I'm addressing myself to the health question. In the first responses provided, the press releases, on one of these at page 3, it refers to September 16th now was the date of this press conference. It was after the pardon decision, in which you're quoted, "I have asked Dr. Lukacs, who is the head physician in the White House, to keep me posted in proper channels as to the former president's health. I have been informed on a routine day-to-day basis, but I don't think I'm at liberty to give information." And my question is, Mr. President, had he reported prior to the pardon date or only after?
Dr. Lukacs gave me no information concerning President Nixon's health prior to the time that I issued the pardon. He did, at my request, when I heard rumors about the former president's health, keep me posted in proper channels, that all occurred after the pardon took place.
Gentleman from Indiana seeking recognition.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to request that we make a part of the record the text of the opinion of the United States Supreme Court in Ex Parte Garland, 4 Wallace 333, and also the opinion of the United States Supreme Court in Verdict Against the United States, 236 U.S. 79, which deals with the point that a pardon must be accepted.
And without objection, it will be made part of the record.
Mr. Chairman, I would also like to make a part of the record, if I may, the article referred to by my colleague, Mr. Hogan, which appeared in the Wall Street Journal of October 16, 1974, and is headed, "The Pardon of Nixon Was Timely, Legal, Jaworski Believes."
Without objection, it is so ordered, and now, briefly,
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
May I add to something I said just to make it correct?
Yes, sir.
Somebody asked about when I last saw the president. I said that I had seen him on the 9th. I did as he departed, but I had also seen the president the morning of the 8th. At the time, I was asked to come and see him, and at that time, we spent an hour and 20 minutes together or thereabouts when he told me that he was going to resign. So I saw him both the 8th and the 9th, just to make the record accurate.
All of us are aware of our time constraints. I'd yield to the gentleman from Wisconsin for a question.
Chairman. I would like to, for the record, indicate that the statement of the gentleman from Maryland, Mr. Hogan, the effect that the proposal that this subcommittee will try to contact certain staff members, such as General Haig and others, was supported by me. I think it would have been excellent. We have in the past done very well in terms of staff work preliminary to hearings that might have helped put some of the questions Ms. Holzman had to rest. Mr. President, you indicated that as far as Mr. Haig was concerned, that he had suggested certain options to you, but did not, in fact, make a recommendation to you with respect to the pardon. Is that correct?
I answered that, I think, as fully as I can in my prepared statement. He discussed the options. He made no recommendation.
Which other persons, to you personally, made recommendations that the former president be pardoned from that time in early August to the day of September 6th when you made your decision?
No other person, to my knowledge, made any recommendation to me from that time until the time that I made a decision about September 6th. Nobody made any recommendation to me for the pardon of the former president.
With respect to discussions between General Haig and Mr. Nixon or other matters in question two, you indicated you had no personal knowledge, both in writing and I think in your statement today. I take it you would have no objection if the subcommittee sought to question Mr. Haig or others on the subject before us this morning to supplement this hearing and this inquiry.
I don't think that's within my prerogative. I've come here to testify as the specific facts as I know them. But what the subcommittee does is a judgment for the subcommittee and not me.
The chair is advised that the House is in recess waiting for the conclusion of this hearing before reconvening. So if I might, I will yield to Mr. Hogan for a question at this point and then to Ms. Holzman for a question. And we will then conclude. Mr. Hogan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. President, on page 20 of your statement, you talk about the health issue and that you had not gotten any official reports from physicians about that were controlling in your decision. You state that observations were reported to you from others. Now, there have been press reports that Dr. Kissinger is alleged to have said to you that he feared that former President Nixon would commit suicide. That appeared in several news accounts. Is there any truth to that?
There's no truth to it whatsoever,
well,
as far as I know.
It appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, on two occasions, and is alluded to in a research paper prepared for the subcommittee. So,
There was no discussion between Dr. Kissinger and myself that included any such comment.
I think, if I might add a gratuitous comment, Mr. Chairman, that much of the controversy has been generated by the press by just such erroneous statements that have been given wide circulation.
Thank you,
Mr. President.
Yes, concise question, because we want to respect the time.
Mr. President, what were the precise instructions given to Benton Becker by you when he went to San Clemente to negotiate the Mr. Nixon's acceptance of the pardon?
The precise instructions given to Mr. Becker were actually given by my counsel, Mr. Buchan. In general, I knew what they were. They were instructions to negotiate the protection of those documents, including the tapes, for the benefit of the special prosecutor in whatever use he felt was essential. and at the same time to keep them inviolate during a period of time which we felt was a proper one.
But not to offer the pardon unless that agreement had been negotiated?
Mr. Edwards, those negotiations as to the custody or ownership of the documents, including tapes, were undertaken prior to August 27th, because we were more or less besieged, when I say we, the White House, as to what to do with those documents, including tapes. And that negotiation had no relevance whatsoever to the decision on my part to pardon the president.
Thank you, Mr. President.
The chair would remind all of the constraints of time and call on Ms. Holzman for one final question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ford, you stated that the theory on which you pardoned Richard Nixon was that he had suffered enough. And I'm interested in that theory because the logical consequence of that is that somebody who resigns in the face of virtually certain impeachment, or somebody who is impeached, should not be punished, because the impeachment or the resignation in face of impeachment is punishment enough. And I wondered whether anybody had brought to your attention the fact that the Constitution specifically states that even though somebody is impeached, that person shall nonetheless be liable to punishment according to law.
Mrs. Holtzman, I was fully cognizant of the fact that the president, on resignation, was accountable for any criminal charges. But I would like to say that the reason I gave the pardon was not as to Mr. Nixon himself. I repeat, and I repeat with emphasis, the purpose of the pardon was to try and get the United States, the Congress, the President, and the American people focusing on the serious problems we have both at home and abroad. And I was absolutely convinced then, as I am now, that if we had had this series, an indictment, a trial, a conviction, and anything else that transpired after that, that the attention of the President, the Congress, and the American people would have been diverted from the problems that we have to solve. And that was the principal reason for my granting of the pardon.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, just before we adjourn this hearing, I again would like to commend the President and thank him for coming. I think, Mr. President, that you have probably opened a new era between the executive and the legislative departments, and I am very happy for it.
Mr. Chairman, I want to express to you and to the other members of the committee or subcommittee my appreciation for the fine manner and I think the fair way in which this meeting was held this morning. I felt that it was absolutely essential, because I'm the only one who could explain the background and the decision-making process. And I hope, as I said in my opening statement, Mr. Chairman, that I have at least cleared the air so that most Americans will understand what was done and why it was done. And again, I trust that all of us can get back to the job of trying to solve our problems both at home and abroad. I thank you very, very much.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, on behalf of the subcommittee, we express our appreciation to your appearance here today and recognition of the responsibility we all have to complete this work and get on with the business. The transcripts will be furnished as quickly as possible to members of the subcommittee. The subcommittee will adjourn subject to call of the chair.
And so President Gerald Ford ends his historic appearance before the subcommittee of the House Judiciary on the House Committee on the Judiciary. The subcommittee is entitled the Hungate Subcommittee. It is, in fact, the officially known as the Subcommittee on Criminal Justice. Today, the subcommittee, as you heard, attempted to learn more about Mr. Ford's pardon of former President Richard M. Nixon. But Ford stuck to his guns and continued to repeat the theme that the pardon was not so much for Mr. Nixon, As he said in his last question to Elizabeth Holtzman, it was not primarily for Nixon's benefit, but for the benefit of the country, so that the country could change its focus and begin to deal with pardons that are with problems other than the Watergate problems. Linda Wertheimer is on Capitol Hill. She has been in the committee room this morning. Linda?
Speaking to members of the subcommittee and to the staff, we have with us Congresswoman Bella Abzug of New York. Mrs. Abzug, it was your privileged inquiry which brought the president to Capitol Hill for this historic event. This is the first time a president has ever testified before a committee of Congress in this way. Were you satisfied that your questions, your 10 questions in the privileged inquiry were answered?
No, I don't think so. I believe that the questions have essentially not been answered. There have been some explanations of fact. It's the fact that some conversations took place with General Haig, for example, but there is no full explanation as to the agreement of the tapes coming at the time that it did, the pardon coming as it did, the negotiations being almost taking place around the same dates. The American people have a right to know what actually transpired. I think it's quite clear from what the president has said here today that General Haig must be called before this committee, that Benton Becker must be called, that Mr. Buchan and Mr. Miller, the people who were involved in both negotiating the agreement of the tapes, by the way, and the agreement with respect to the pardon. And it strains a bit of credulity to believe that, as the president testified, that General Haig discussed with the president very early in August the fact that there were terrible problems of possible exposure, which would lead to his impeachment, and talked with him about different ways in which the president could leave office, including pardoning himself, pardoning everybody, and believed that there was no relationship in a discussion of pardoning with the president who was then vice president. In other words, the whole subject has just begun to be discussed, and I think we have to unravel it. And I think this committee is charged with the responsibility to call General Haig, to call Mr. Becker, call Mr. Miller, call Mr. Ron Ziegler, call Mr. Buzhardt, by the way, who was extremely involved with the whole question of tapes and the evidence. The questions will still be asked by the American people. Was the pardon granted to prevent an indictment of Nixon? Were the tape agreements entered into in order to prevent the exposure of evidence, both for further prosecutions of IT&T and the milk lobby, or to conceal conversations that were held between President Nixon and Vice President Ford?
Mrs. Abzug, you were not permitted to ask the questions yourself beyond putting them into the resolution, because the committee took over that role. Did you feel that they were standing in for you as in the best way that they could? Were they as firm? Did they probe well enough?
Well, I think a certain amount of referential deference was showed, as one sort of expects. I want to remind the committee and the public, though, that this president is a non-elected president, and you have to earn that kind of deference. That what's at stake is the very fundamentals of our system of equal justice. And there was a tendency, except in one or two instances, of the members not to probe deeply. The limitations of the hearing are such, in any case, that it's hard to have a back-and-forth probing when you have only 5 minutes. Therefore, it's essential that the committee continue, that it call witnesses, that it demand certain documents. There were legal memoranda written by Mr. Jaworski and LaCorey, his assistant, with respect to the pardon, with respect to its relationship to the indictment. Those documents should be presented here. All of the tapes, I think, that refer to the pardon or refer to a discussion of the agreement of the tapes should be brought before this committee, listened to, and made available so that we can determine, in fact, what did take place. And any conversations between the president and the vice president, meaning ex-President Nixon, Vice President Ford, or President Ford, and any other person, should be brought before this committee.
Do you think that do you have any assurance that the committee will do that?
I think we must press that the committee does do that.
Thank you very much. Congresswoman Bella Abzug of New York, who was the first person to bring the privileged resolution of inquiry. She was the first mover behind this series of hearings, and Mrs. Abzug was talking about her feeling about the way the hearings went, whether they answered her questions, whether she was satisfied with the results.
The questions, according to Representative Abzug today, bordered on being obsequious, with the exception of Representative Elizabeth Holzman. She is in the committee room now with our congressional correspondent, Linda Wertheimer.
Congresswoman Elizabeth Holzman was the most serious questioner during this hearing and probed perhaps more deeply than any other member, and you just received some abuse from a member of the audience for having done so.
No, the member of the audience said that I was being too hard on the former president, that one should not think about the suffering he visited on the country. It had nothing to do with Mr. Ford.
Do you think that Mr. Ford had responded satisfactorily? Do you think this inquiry was a good way to elicit the information you wanted?
No, as I said in my statement, I thought the format of this inquiry could not, by its very nature, allow the committee to get to the full truth and to satisfy the public suspicion, which I think is very important. I think it's very important to restore credibility in the processes of government. I also think that President Ford did not answer the question I asked him as to whether he was willing to turn over the tapes of his conversations with Richard Nixon while Richard Nixon was president.
Will the committee make any effort to get those tapes or documents or other witnesses?
Well, I think we'll have to discuss this at a later time. I certainly hope that we do.
Ms. Holzman, you took up almost all your time in making your statement and left very little time for the president. Why didn't you sacrifice some of your time so that he could answer one of your questions?
Because I thought the important thing, and let me say first that I did ask him specifically two questions, one of which he did not answer. But I felt it was very important to state to the public that they should not expect this hearing to answer all of the questions, that this hearing would not close the book on the pardon, and that I was disturbed that it wouldn't, because frankly I think the president is a busy man, and I don't think that we ought to prolong this any more than is necessary. And I thought there were ways in which we could have prepared for this hearing that would possibly have permitted this hearing to resolve all the issues, but it has not resolved the issues, and I think it's important for the public to realize that.
Thank you very much. Congresswoman Elizabeth Holzman, Democrat of New York, who asked some of the most searching questions this afternoon at the inquiry. We'll be looking for more members of the committee and for more reaction, but for now, back to the studio and to Richard Halwell.
Back now to the committee room and Linda Wertheimer.
Congressman Henry Smith of New York, you're the Republican ranking member of the committee, and you had the incredible and unusual experience of sitting there seeing a president of your own party testify before the Congress in something that has never happened before. Were your questions answered? Were you satisfied?
Yes, my questions were answered, and I think probably that the president today, as far as I can see, answered all of the outstanding questions that anybody had and that he had not answered before in his press conferences and his statements. As a matter of fact, his answers today were so complete that it made it a little bit difficult for the committee to find questions to ask him.
Do you think that there's anything more, anything that the committee can do, any new information or information from other sources that the committee should seek?
No, I don't think so. I think you either believe the President of the United States, and it just happens that I think he's a man of the greatest integrity, and I do, or you think he's a liar. I don't think he's a liar by any stretch of the imagination.
The President, in his own inimitable, very open and candid and earnest way, talked about the pardon as a simple act of mercy, uncomplicated by any considerations having to do with culpability of other persons or having anything to do with anything but the good of the country. Now, do you feel that that's all the story?
Yes, I do, and I'd like to say that the emphasis that he put on it today was not so much a simple act of mercy. It was not so much Mr. Nixon as it was for the benefit and the good of this country to get to try to bring back tranquility, as he said in his statement that he made at the time, and to get this country back to consider all of the great problems that face us and hopefully stop taking up so much of our time in wondering about, talking about, thinking about, fighting about all of the Watergate-related matters.
Jerry Ford's been an astute politician for many years, a long career, and yet he made an apparent misjudgment of the sentiment of the American people when he pardoned the president and a wave of protest broke over him, which he apparently did not expect. Do you think that this hearing is going to satisfy the people?
Well, right after the pardon, I stated that the pardon met my sense of justice, and that I thought that in the long run, people would come around generally to the belief that the pardon, if it was going to be done, should be done quickly and done when he did it. And I agree with Mr. Jaworski then that it was timely and legal. I think that because it was dramatic is one of the reasons it stirred up a great deal of protest. I think there will always be protest among people of differing minds about it. Mr. Main indicated today that he didn't think it should have been done so quickly. I disagree with him. The president disagreed with him. There will always be disagreement, but I think in the long run that it was for the best interests of this country, done when it was done.
Thank you very much, Congressman Henry Smith of New York. And back to the studio to Richard Hallwell.
Funds for this broadcast provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, technical assistance from Jeff Geller and Jim McEachran. It was produced by Todd Easton. Thanks to Linda Wertheimer on Capitol Hill. This is Richard Hallwell. This program was brought to you by NPR, National Public Radio.